Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio on your last weekend in March. I hope you've had a great beginning of spring. I certainly have. And we have a lot to cover today on the show. We're going to be talking specifically about IVF and donor conception, sperm and egg donation, and some of the drawbacks and harms that go along with that. But before we do, we're going to start out, as always, with a little bit of Bible time. I've been spending some time in Zechariah, and this is a time where some of the exiles are returning from Babylon, and they are working to rebuild the spiritual culture and the political culture, and specifically the temple in Jerusalem. It is a time of national rebuilding after it has been savaged by foreign forces. And I kind of have this feeling that that's a little bit where the United States is now. We have been savaged by an ideology, a woke ideology, that has worked to destroy the foundations of this nation, its history, its politics, its culture, and certainly the roots of family. And so I feel like the instructions in Zechariah really apply to where we are today. It talks about how the hands of Zerubbabel, the political leader, is going to lay the foundation of the temple. He's going to be able to finish it. And that he is going to work for the Lord is with him. And then he has this very interesting admonition. And that is not to despise the day of small things. And when we are working to build anything, the work begins small. I am sure that Zerubbabel felt overwhelmed by the task before him, a complete rebuilding of people that didn't really have any idea what it was like to live in their own nation under their own laws, worshiping at their own temple and serving their own God. And we are in a place now where we need to rebuild, especially a family culture here in the United States. But I also thought, man, this really applies to building your individual family as well. And I remember those years when my children were young, when I had three kids under five or four kids under 10, and how exhausting it was and how every day felt like a year. And I did despise the day of small things in a lot of ways. It was hard for me to get up out of bed and have enough energy to get all the way through the day. Even though I loved being with my kids, it was long-suffering and taxing. And yet, because my husband and I worked so hard to lay the foundation in terms of training our kids and building a strong relationship with them, they're now teenagers and young adults. And I do feel like our hands have gotten to finish it in some ways. Not that we're done with the parenting journey, but we're out of the years of small things. So wherever you find yourself, whether you are working to restore something on a national stage, on a social level, or whether you are working to construct your own family and you're at home with kids, those days of small things are so important to the long-term success and the overall flourishing of that institution, whether it is the institution of your own family or the institution of, you know, the government in the United States. So be strong and courageous and work for the Lord is with you. Today, I am joined by my engagement director, Patience Sunny, and we're going to hit a big item in the news today, big in the world of children's rights, because what we do at Them Before Us is we defend the fundamental natural rights of children, specifically their right to life and their right to be known and loved by their mother and father. Now, there are big enemies to those rights today in the United States, whether you're talking about some of the legal changes that we are making in the definition of parenthood or the definition of marriage. There's enemies in terms of the cultural changes, in terms of our expectations of families, like women don't need a man and love makes a family. But there are very serious technological threats to a child's right to life and right to their mother and father. We often talk about IVF being a threat to children's right to life in addition to abortion, but reproductive technologies like IVF also threaten children's right to be known and loved by their mother and father, because when you're making babies in a laboratory, it's just as easy to use somebody else's sperm or egg rather than the own mother or father or adults that are going to be taking the child home. For decades, many of these children had no idea that they did not belong to the father specifically that was raising them. Many of them only learned that they were conceived through an egg donor or a sperm donor when they were able to take an at-home DNA test, where they would swab the inside of their cheek, gather a sample of saliva, send it back, and then this massive database would tell them if they had any direct biological relatives, half-siblings, cousins, maybe even a biological parent that they did not know was their biological parent. Now, one of the biggest companies that provides these at-home DNA testing kits is 23andMe. And they made a major announcement this month. So, patience, tell us a little bit about what's going on with 23andMe right now.
Yeah, so 23andMe is one of the major at-home DNA testing companies in the United States. And it just announced that they're filing bankruptcy. So with that announcement, there's a lot of questions that are being raised about what happens to user data. This is coming on the heels of, in October 2023, hackers accessed the confidential information of 7 million customers of 23andMe. So there were already some concerns with the company, and now they're announcing bankruptcy. And immediately after they announced that, the Attorney General of California issued a consumer alert urging residents to delete their genetic data from 23andMe's website. So customers can request that the company destroy their saliva samples, and their DNA information, any information that they had on their database. But Unheard raises the point that there are also some significant geopolitical privacy concerns going on here as well. So last month, O'Keefe Media Group published an undercover video conversation with a U.S. Treasury advisor who warned that the firm shares its data with shareholding companies, some of which the advisor claimed are owned by Russian and Chinese governments. So even if this is an unfounded speculation, 23andMe's data policy says that customer data is an asset that can be sold if the company goes bankrupt or if the company is sold. So the potential sale of millions of mostly American DNA sequences isn't something to be treated lightly. That's a big deal. That's a lot of sensitive data. And if it gets into the wrong hands, it could potentially pose a national security threat. If a government unfriendly to the United States is able to obtain massive amounts of American DNA data through the sale of 23andMe.
Well, I think that's absolutely nuts. You know, to have come into this world by some other party than the one that raised you to not know about it, or sometimes you did know about it, but this was sort of your access point of getting biological information about your missing parent or missing parents, maybe the missing half siblings that you knew or even didn't know existed, and to have it sort of be a portal to discovering your biological identity. And then to have that identity sold or acquired or hacked by people that may not be friendly, certainly to you, but maybe not even to, you know, the broader national security concerns as well. To me, that's just absolutely insane. I didn't know that there was, that caveat in the operating manual that customer data is an asset that can be sold. Sold.
Yeah, if absolutely.
If it goes bankrupt, that's absolutely not. So we're talking about crazy privacy violations, but also a national security risk. Patience, what do you think about the pros or cons of these at-home DNA tests? Like, there really are some significant risks to using these tools. And yet, it is really, in a lot of cases, the only pathway that some children have to discovering, or maybe some parents have, to discovering biological relatives that they weren't aware of or that they're trying to find. So where's the balance there?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, 23andMe, you know, it wasn't initially advertised to people as, hey, this is a way for donor-conceived individuals and adoptees to track down their roots. It was just, a fun thing that you could do at home, find out, you know, if your great-grandma's assertion that your family's Italian is actually true. And, you know, find out what your history is. And, you know, that was really what made it take off, where a lot of its popularity was. But it very quickly became obvious that this was a tool for people who were trying to track down their origins. And it's been a really valuable tool for a lot of people. People use it through donor conceived sibling registries. People have used it to find, their biological parents if they were adopted at birth. And so it's done a lot of good for a lot of people. But at the same time, it does have these vulnerabilities. And one of the things that's particularly striking to me is that these vulnerabilities wouldn't have to exist for donor-conceived individuals if states had actually made efforts to protect them in the first place. Mm-hmm. Nobody should have to go through an at-home DNA test to try and find out what their family history is, what their origins are, who their parents are. And that's something that for a lot of adoptees in a lot of states, there have been efforts to unseal adoption records, to give adoptees access to their original birth certificates and give them tools to find their first family, find their half-siblings who may be out there, grandparents, cousins, and also find their family medical history, which is a very important piece for a lot of people. But that same effort hasn't existed for donor-conceived individuals in most states. There's only one state in the nation that has banned anonymous donation. And even that state isn't requiring that birth certificates reflect that reality. It's relying on clinics to keep those records. So then, if a clinic goes out of business before someone turns 18, they might never be able to access their origins. And that's why people turn to things like 23andMe in order to find their origins, because the government has failed them. And in many cases, the adults in their lives have failed them as well by choosing to put their own desires first and by denying these children access to their first family.
I remember when the internet was on the rise, probably when I was, let me date myself, like early 30s, when really everybody was starting to just get beyond dial up and really have high speed internet. At the time, the number one category of websites that were out there was pornography. I mean, pornography has always gobbled up the largest swaths of internet real estate out there. But the second highest Googled and sought after terms were hereditary, was ancestry, that there was such a fascination and curiosity and drive for people to research, where did I come from? What's my family history? Can I complete my family tree? And it seemed to be not just a hobby for some, but an obsession for many. And it makes sense, right? It is very hard to answer the question, who am I, if you cannot answer the question, whose am I? And sometimes that goes back several generations. And there is something about finding out, like you said, oh my gosh, I always thought I was Irish, but turns out I'm mostly Russian. And that actually has a big impact on how we think about ourselves. So here we are with this massive industry that exists so that people can discover their ethnic and genetic heritage, right? All of these ancestry sites and services and ways of discovering, family going back centuries even. And there we clearly understand the importance of that generational transmission of information as it relates to our ethnic or our national identity or our biological identity. And yet we have created an entire industry that is made to deny children half or all of their genetic information, of their biological identity. And here it is, I think, again, we've just got a culture talking out of two sides of its mouth. On the one side, we say, wow, it's so wonderful to like embrace your heritage and like, I'm a Latina and like I said, I'm Italian. That's why we, every Christmas we always make our famous grandfather's Italian meatballs and we recognize that that is precious and special. And then on the other hand, when we say, but we really want a baby and we're going to purchase a child's genetic material from their mother or father so that we can make a baby, and intentionally cut them off from half that heritage and maybe hide it from them because that's inconsequential. Well, now you see that heritage and genealogy matters when adults want it to, but it's absolutely inconsequential when they don't want it to. It's just more data in the direction of we've got an adult-obsessed culture and we need to return to a child-centric culture. We'll be back with a fascinating interview in our next segment.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We are going to do a little special something during this segment. I want to give you a peek into the life of somebody who was created through sperm donation. Somebody that was raised intentionally apart from their biological father. Now, this is a woman who grew up in the home of a married mom and dad, a Christian mom and dad. So she had her own mother in the home, and she had a father in the home. And yet, there was still something missing. She didn't know as she grew up that she was created through sperm donation, and her brother did not know either. And then they had a jolt, a shock to their system when they found out as young adults and how challenging it was for her to, in essence, have to remake her identity. So we want to give you a little glimpse into that world, because I think that even in the Christian world, some of us have this idea that as long as it's a mother and father, it's fine. Or maybe this is an acceptable way to deal with infertility. And if the child's raised by a married mom and dad, then no harm, no foul. Well, I want you to have a little listen to Katie Francisco's story. And at the end of this, hopefully you will come away knowing that it is adults, even loving, heterosexual, married adults, who need to sacrifice so children don't have to, because if we choose to solve our problems of infertility by using a third party's sperm or a third party's egg or a third party's womb, it is the children who are going to suffer, oftentimes for life.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Them Before Us podcast in our special series on IVF, What Happens When IVF Becomes Right. I'm Jen Friesen, your host, and we're joined as always by our engagement director, Patient Sunny. Today, we continue our series with a special guest, Catherine Francisco. She's a woman who was born from donor conception and has done advocacy work, sharing her story and supporting restorative reproductive medicine. She's previously served 6 years as operations manager for Canavox, the Marriage and Family Project of the Wetherspoon Institute, and 3 years for the International Institute for Restorative Reproductive Medicine as secretariat. She met her husband while living in New Jersey and now supports him full-time while raising their children in sunny Naples, Florida. She's here to share a story with us and her opinion about IVF and donor conception and all the things we've been engaging with on the show. And she's been a longtime friend and fellow advocate of the Them Before Us organization. Well, I should say of Katie Faust before we even were an organization. Mm-hmm. And we're so thankful to have you on the podcast. Welcome, Catherine.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer. And patient.
We'd love to just have you start by sharing your personal story. And it's almost like, you know, how did you get involved with this topic? It's like, well, you know, it wasn't your choice per se, but we would just love to hear, you know, what brought you to this point.
So I was pretty oblivious to this stuff until I was almost 22. My parents sat me down and told me that I was conceived through sperm donation, which was shocking to me. I had kind of signs growing up that weren't glaring to me because I really looked like my mom and people said that to me. But my brother didn't feel that way about our dad. So we were raised in a man, woman home. I have one full sibling. They were told, you know, if you want another sibling, my brother's 4 years older than me. My parents were told, if you want another sibling, for your son, then this sperm donor is leaving in the next year. And so then I was conceived. And they had tried several times. I think I have two full siblings in heaven too. So it was definitely a long journey for my mom. My dad, who raised me, kind of, I think he had the sense that he had infertility just because of past health issues. And they didn't really know, I think, until they were married and, you know, not getting pregnant. Well, I guess the old school way of doing donor conception, where it was, you know, they were encouraged to lie to us. They signed a form at the hospital saying, you know, we are the parents, so we will be raising the children. Almost like washing away the fact that my father was a resident at that hospital and that was my actual father, you know. So I see donor conception as just coded in lies. And, you know, it starts off with these ugly, disconnected acts
like bodily acts, you know, there's pornography involved. There's, again, lying, especially in my case. It's becoming, I think, more common to do non-anonymous donation where, but even still, you're still creating, you know, 20 kids who won't be raised by their natural father. Full brother ended up finding our father, and we met him several years ago. I don't remember the exact number. I think it was 6 years ago. We met him in person because it was right. It was like the year before I got married. And I met him, and my husband actually said, you know, he could tell that I was then ready to get married. I had just felt really unsettled. So 3 weeks after my trip to Kansas City to meet my father, my husband proposed. So we got married the next year. And since then, we've had at least, I want to say, 5 or 6 half-siblings show up, some through DNA testing. 2 were through my father's, my biological father's marriage, they're pretty estranged from the family. But I met one, I met him the night before I met my father. And my siblings have been such a gift because they understand the suffering. And one of them, his mom told him when he was 7. So for him, he at least had the benefit of growing up with the news, but it was still really hard to hear that when he was 7 too. And it's still a suffering. So yeah, that's kind of my background and my family tree at the moment. It's always growing.
Yeah. In your story you share on the website, you talk about light bulb moments growing up. You didn't understand them in context, that you felt maybe disconnected from your social father, or you felt like maybe your parents were not telling you the truth. Can you describe some of those moments just growing up? You said you learned about this when you were in your 20s. What things did you experience growing up that made you feel disconnected in some way?
Just for example, looking at my nose, no one in my family had the same nose as me on either side of the family. And when you look at my father, it's like, wow, I have his exact nose. So there's no surprise there. My brother sent me a photo of him before we met him, and I started crying because I looked just like him. So that was one example. Another one is just moments with our dad where I was, you know, we were out to breakfast or something and we really didn't talk that much. We would just kind of sit there. And he'd also, he had kind of, I think subconsciously or unconsciously disconnected when I was in college. He just stopped reaching out as much. Looking back, it's possible this was in the time period before I found out, where it was awkward because my brother knew for 8 months before I did. So it's possible my dad was just avoiding me because he didn't want to have the conversation, you know. But my brother said that, you know, if you don't tell Katie, that's what my family calls me. If you don't tell Katie, you know, in 8 months, I'm going to tell her. And 8 months, almost to the day, is when they told me.
Yeah. Can you say a little bit more about when they did tell you, when you first found out? What questions did that answer or create for you?
Oh, man, I just felt so horrible. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go into a hole and hide. I literally left my parents' house and I wanted to go to a movie theater and watch a movie. That's all I wanted to do. I ended up going to a friend's house who was in between my parents' house and our University of Florida. So I showed up to her parents' house and her mom said, "Oh, you are so loved." And that's just not how I felt. I felt like trash. Someone wrote a New York Times piece where he did a photo exhibit of all of his siblings. And you know, throughout the stories, you get the sense, and some people even specifically say, you know, I feel like a statistic being donor conceived. When you're in a natural family, there's your family and that's it. And you're kind of, you fit there. Even if you don't feel like you fit in all the time or something, you at least can rest in the place of your family. And, you know, you only have a few siblings, if any. But when you're created in this way, it just creates a sense of like I just don't matter, and like I wasn't first choice. My parents' first choice would obviously have been to get pregnant naturally. That's everyone's first choice. So those are kind of the immediate emotions that honestly haven't gone away. I have found a lot of healing through my marriage and through my faith. Yeah. God has definitely been good to me. So,
yeah. Thank you for sharing that. When you shared your story in the public discourse, you described your reaction to seeing a woman's Facebook post about considering becoming an egg donor and the one-sided empathy that she expressed. Can you tell our audience about that experience? How does donor conception show empathy for the parents at the expense of the child?
Yeah, it's just kind of, you know, the adults are in our faces, so it's easy to have compassion for them. I even had a moment in college where I had compassion for couples who are infertile, and I suggested in a blog post their methods so they can have children now. But I felt really weird saying that and eerie, and I think I ended up not publishing the post, or I turned it into my class. It was like one of 10 blog posts or something I had to do for a journalism class. I ended up not like going back and advertising this blog or something. I felt weird about it because it's just not thinking of where children are meant to be and what's best for them. I was actually talking to Katie Faust about this a few months ago, just how several of my siblings have actually been to jail or prison, and I don't think they've gone to college. And she said that confirms research by Brad Wilcox, that you're actually more likely to be imprisoned than go to college if you are raised without your biological father. And it's true. It's not good to not have your biological father. That's why I think, you know, with adoption, it's become more of the norm to have open adoption. With donor conception, it's more the norm to have open donors. But all the same, you're still not being raised by your natural parents. And so where adoption kind of is trying to heal and take care of a tough situation, donor conception is actually creating that situation intentionally. It's madness. If people really thought about it and they looked at the research, then it would be illegal.
I think it's so hard for people who probably aren't in this situation to fathom. It's not just that you were raised by a single mom and you didn't know your dad, and then your dad shows up. It's that what you thought was true and your experience of like, this is my mom and this is my dad, felt there were some things about it that fell off or whatever it was. But then to be sat down and told, you know, just earth shattering changes. So, you know, what was it like? Okay, so you learn that your social dad is not your biological father. You said you met your biological dad 6 years ago, I think is what you said. Maybe you learned.
Yeah, I found out 13 years ago.
13 years ago, yeah. But you're still, I mean, you're processing, right? I mean, how do people, these are huge concepts for someone to process. So when you met him, yeah, what was that like? You know, that first face-to-face of like, this is the person I came from. You've never met him before. You don't know him. I don't know if you'd seen a picture or something. Can you just tell us a little bit about what that experience was like?
Yeah, I had seen a picture and I had talked to him on the phone a couple of times. And I had even talked to his cousin on the phone, and she and I sounded similar in our voices, the way we said things, even though we grew up in different parts of the country. So meeting him was so awesome because I walked up to his door. He opens it and he just looks like a dad. He's got like the dad body. He's got the dad baldness. And he was mine. You know, he was my dad. And it felt so good to just spend time with him. We sat in a restaurant and talked for something like 3 or 4 hours. And to kind of feel at peace, like it just felt really natural. You know, he listened really well. He liked talking a lot. That's kind of all of my siblings and I get this from him, where we like to talk a lot. We have to think out loud a lot, but we also are good listeners. And he's like that. And that's why he was a psychiatrist for so long. So yeah, meeting him was such a gift. I don't keep in touch with him a lot. That's kind of the process where I am now. You talked about processing, you know, it takes a long time. It's over the whole lifetime. So as more daughters have popped up and live closer to him, and as my life has become more of, I'm like living in a little cocoon with my children, taking care of my husband. So I don't always have time to call, and I don't always make time to call. And I should, but it's also, I have this sense that maybe it's a fear really that I will disappoint him. And it's not so mutual. Like he'll never be able to visit me. He's just not in the place to do that. So part of me just doesn't want my heart to be broken again, you know? So I'm kind of in this weird spot where I recognize and I love him as my father, but I also don't want to get too close because of the reality of how our relationship started.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of the only nonprofit on the globe solely devoted to defending children's rights to their mother and father. We talk a lot about policy. We talk a lot about trending news. You just got a peek into an interview that we did on our most recent IVF podcast series, IVF FYI, What Happens When IVF Becomes a Right, that illuminates so many aspects of the big fertility industry that you probably are not aware of. Really shocking, egregious things like massive destruction of embryos and eugenics-like processes of deciding which embryos live and which embryos die, fertility fraud. It is all there. So if you really want to take a deep dive into the corruption and destruction of little lives that takes place because of this industry, go over to the Them Before Us podcast and check it out. But right now, we are going to answer some of the questions that we have received from you throughout the week. And to do that, as always, I have my training director, Jen Friesen, here, who is going to pitch questions and help us answer some of them. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Katie. Hi, everyone. Good to be here. First question says, hi, Katie. Love your work. Do you have any specific advice for widowed fathers? My wife passed away 3 years ago, and I am a solo dad of three young boys.
Oh, my gosh. That is awful. When you want to talk about tragedy, it's hard to think of something with a bigger impact than losing a parent in the early years. Losing your mother obviously leaves a huge gaping hole, a major wound in the life of children. I'm going to give a few data points, but really the main thing that you need to be aware of is having loving, wonderful people in your life who support you and who know you, your church community, the pastor of your church, your good friends. They're really going to have a lot to say as you move forward as a single dad or if you choose to date and remarry. But let's talk a little bit about the pluses and minuses of that. First of all, I am sure that you recognize that children need moms, and your children have lost something very, very precious and valuable. But you should also recognize that just because you're in a romantic relationship with a woman, that does not mean that she is going to love your children the way that your wife loved them. There are incredible redemptive step-parents who often do step into the gap left by an absent biological parent or deceased biological parent, but that has got to factor heavily into your dating decisions and your dating calibration. At Them Before Us, we talk about the risk of unrelated adults in the home, and it's statistically significant. It's so significant that sociologists have a term for it, and it's called the Cinderella effect. Now, we know about the fairy tales of the Cinderella effect, where children receive disproportionately bad treatment from a step parent. And while we see that very pronounced in the literature as it relates to mother's live-in boyfriend or a new stepfather, as it relates to increased risk of abuse, the Cinderella story is named for a stepmother. And we do have data on unrelated women, unrelated mothers, stepmothers, providing less care for the children in their home when they have both a biological child and a stepchild. So it's just something to be aware of. But I will also say this, that children who lose a parent to death often fare better, or at least we have two studies that show that they fare better than children who lose a parent to divorce. There is something about that loss that happened through tragedy rather than a loss that happened through some level of adult intentionality that sits differently with a child, probably because they know that their mother would be there if she could. And they know that you and everybody else in their world look back on her with fondness and sweetness and wish that she could still be here. So when they experience grief or express their loss, they're not experiencing that alone. And that actually is a major tick in the column of your children being able to move forward into a place of healing. Should you decide to get remarried, it's just something to be incredibly aware of, that you are not just finding yourself a wife. This woman has to be equally interested in being the mother that your boys so desperately need. Jen, do you have anything you want to chime in on about that?
Yeah, I was just curious, really well said. I was just curious what you would say about dating. You know, it's, you know, when would you introduce your kids to that individual? How are you sussing out if the person is also interested in being a mother? And, you know, even it's just fascinating to think about, how do you decide, you know, if you're integrating someone into your life, is it still that they're kind of the add-on, but you're the primary disciplinarian, you're the, you know, well, hey, we disagree, so this is how we're going to do it. Or does there need to be an understanding of they're stepping in fully and have just as much investment, and you don't get to say it's my kids? You know, what would your thoughts be for things like that?
Well, in terms of like, when do you introduce, I would say incredibly carefully. I know some little girls that lost their mother at a very young age, and the father was not a Christian, and he had a variety of different live-in girlfriends who came into the home, acted like a mother figure. And then after a month or two or a year, they were gone. So the kids learned to attach, and then they grieved. And then a couple months later, there was a new woman there. So I will tell you, number one, don't have sex. Don't let sex complicate this. And also, I will say, don't let the absolute need to have somebody help with the housework and the driving and the picking up and the mothering force you to make a decision that really isn't. I mean, you probably are in a need where you are stressed. There's more work than you can do. And it would be really helpful to have somebody else who can help with, you know, not just the childcare, but like everything else going on in your life. Don't let that interfere with the very clear lens that you need to have when you're evaluating a potential future wife and mother for your kids. That's why I was saying, get your pastors involved, get your friends involved, you know, get real accountability. Let somebody else look at this through the lens of objectively, is this going to be a good fit? Because otherwise your overwhelming need to just have help or to have sex is going to cloud your vision. And that's not going to be good for your kids. When do you introduce them? Sticky. That is something that on the ground intel with the people you know who know you most and best is going to be, it's going to best come from them. But you don't want to do it too soon. You probably don't want to do it until you know that this person is going to be a permanent fixture. And even then, you want to do it gradually. People, step-parents that come in and immediately start to take on the mantle of parent, they have not earned the right to discipline. They have not earned the right to enforce those boundaries. You do not want an era or an environment of disrespect, but you, the biological parent, always has to be, well, at least for many, many years, the primary disciplinarian in that scenario. And the step-parent should be ancillary to that a lot of the time. If the children are very young and if they develop a really robust, trusting relationship, then yeah, that kind of discipline situation can happen later on, but not right away.
That's good. Good thoughts. Okay, next question. My husband and I are considering international adoption, but we've been warned that sometimes children placed for adoption aren't truly orphans. How can we make sure our desire to help doesn't unintentionally participate in child trafficking or corruption?
This is a very important and challenging question because I don't know of many countries that have not been tainted by some kind of allegation or verifiable scandal as it relates to children in need. Especially when you're talking about infants overseas. Interestingly, just this week, there was a story that broke about South Korea, which was, as far as I know, the nation with the highest number of children who were adopted by international couples, disproportionate numbers to Europe and the United States. And the first national investigation in South Korea's what's called Truth and Reconciliation Commission discovered that children were sent away like luggage for profit for decades. Adoption agencies falsified documents to present babies as orphans when they had known parents. Sometimes babies would die before they were flown overseas and other babies were swapped in their place. Now, I don't know how prevalent this was, but unfortunately, when you do have money involved, there is a risk that it's no longer about the best interest of the child. There can be safeguards. There must be safeguards put in place to try and elevate the best interest of the child. But as far as we've seen, those systems have been infiltrated in a lot of ways. And a lot of that is important and needs to be scrutinized because a child being needlessly taken from their parents without their knowledge, or a trafficking situation under the guise of adoption is an absolute affront to children, to their safety, to their rights, and it must be condemned and challenged and rooted out and destroyed. On the other hand, I have been to those orphanages where children were not adopted. I have seen the kids with light bulb shaped blue fingertips because they had holes in their heart. And their parents abandoned them because they had a medical condition and no Chinese couple wanted to adopt that child because they weren't related and they didn't want a special needs kid. And American couples took them home and saved their lives. So it's a tough balance. So how do you get into this in a way that as much as possible means that you're not complicit in some kind of trafficking situation? Honestly, my recommendation is go for the kids that are unwanted. I mean, if you're going for the drug-free infant, I think that there's a little more of a risk there that you're going to be involved in a situation that may not be in the child's best interest. But if you go for the kid that nobody wants, you know, not only are you going to be fulfilling the mandate to care for the true orphan, but there's a better chance that they genuinely are in need.
That's really good. Wow. Okay, final few minutes here. Really easy question for you here on poly relationships. So this person said, we have friends who we used to be close to who are now polyamorous and raising a child together with a third adult partner. They say the child's loved and thriving. How can I explain why a stable married mom and dad is still best without sounding judgmental?
Yeah, this is really interesting. Polyamory is on the rise, even though we don't legally have legal polygamous marriage yet. The prevalence and acceptability of polyamorous relationships, that is multiple adults in relationship together, is gaining more and more acceptance across the United States. And there's little hubs and networks, you know, in specific cities where it's more prevalent than others. It's really interesting because I met a couple maybe 10 years ago. And they were just a normal couple. We were involved in sort of a mutual enterprise, let's just say. And we met them at a lake and we had lunch with them and it was our kids and it was their child. And they just seemed like a down-to-earth family. And then I saw them again a couple of years later at another kind of like group picnic. But it wasn't just that child. It was another child that they had adopted. And it wasn't the dad that I met the original time. It was some other guy. And it was very, very clear that this woman was in a relationship with him. Their hands were all over each other. I mean, it was uncomfortable to be having a picnic blanket right next to theirs because all of the touch was obviously hypersexual. And When I asked her about her family, she mentioned her husband, so he was still clearly in the picture. You know, she mentioned that they had just gone on vacation, the three of them, and so it was very obvious that they had a polyamorous relationship. But what was stunning to me is when I had met them before, their one child at the time was sitting on the blanket, you know, very calm, just eating his snacks, you know, picking raisins out of a box, going down to explore the lake shore, throwing rocks in the water. But not this time. This time with this unrelated guy where there was what I would say was a very sexually charged environment. The boy and now his new brother were just frenetic. Like they were just bouncing off the walls. You know, they were like picking at the grass and they were like rolling. And then they were climbing all over both adults. Like it was very clear that the children were not settled. There was something about the energy in the household that was not calming for the kids at all. And it was just a really stunning observation because I got to see sort of the before and after of what it looked like to add that extra adult to your home. And obviously this is being pushed in the name of, hey, there's more love in the house. There's more adults that are going to be able to help with the kids. I'll tell you what, the kids were not helped by this. Now, from a statistical standpoint, we know that unrelated adults sharing living spaces with children always statistically increases risks of abuse and neglect. So I don't necessarily know. I don't even think that this guy was abusing the boys, but his inclusion in the household statistically increases that risk for them. I mean, and it's not even really a negotiable question. So I would just say, look at it from the child's perspective, that anytime there is somebody other than the mom and dad in the home raising the kids, it does not increase well-being for children. In fact, it may drastically decrease the likelihood that they're genuinely going to be safe and loved. Jen, you want to throw in some final thoughts there?
You know, it's such a fascinating, I mean, you said there was a psychologist that saw that a child seeing their mom and dad loving each other it was the only way that children are loved sort of by extension. And it does not apply when you see mom being all over random boyfriend number one, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That there is something where the child feels loved indirectly. When they see the mother loving their father, they feel like their mother's loving them. When they see father loving mother, they feel like their father is loving them. But when they see their mother loving her boyfriend, they don't think, she loves me. They think, get away from my mom. Leave her alone. Or at minimum, they're like, well, I guess she's loving him. I'll just wait until she's done. There's definitely a different dynamic when it's a child's own mother and father. And that means that all of us, single, married, gay, straight, fertile, infertile, and maybe even those who might identify as polyamorous, need to put kids first and love and marry only their mother and father and stay together for life.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.